My name is Melissa Potter, and I'm speaking with Thelma Demerson, a woman who was incarcerated in 1939 under the Female Refuge Act, and she's currently involved in a charter challenge against the act, which has since been repealed, to have it declared unconstitutional. Hi, Thelma. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Melissa.
I thought first we could give just a brief description of the Female Refuge Act and what it entailed, and then we'll talk about some of your specific experiences. So the Female Refuge Act, I'll let you put it in your own words, but it basically allowed the Ontario government to arrest any women that they deemed incorrigible, women who were single parents, or who I think were public drunkenness was another reason. Basically a tool that allowed them to just about lock up any woman when you have defined the term incorrigible.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. The Female Refuge Act was brought in later in the latter part of the century. However, in 1913, the Ontario government called it an industrial refuge for women between the ages of 15 and 35. The federal government has declared the industrial refuge as a children's home. So actually what happened was that the women were literally, under the act, became children. Another thing, too, is that in the act there was some mention of I can't remember, but it had to do with them being subjected to labor or hard labor, something like this. And this also was in the act, but children, it didn't comply with the idea of an industrial refuge for children. Women who were put into this, into a refuge, were considered to be somewhat feeble-minded, although there was nothing in the act to suggest that they were. And then in 1919, that would be a few years later, this would be with when the troops were coming back from the First World War, they introduced another section, 15. And section 15 actually came in and stated that women who were incorrigible and idle and dissolute could be arrested. Now, this wasn't in the 1913 Act. In the 1913 Act, you had to commit some offense, no matter how trifling, under $10 or something, but stealing. But the whole idea in 1919, well, for whatever reason, women were brought in, and like, for instance, in my case, my parents declared I was in, had me committed. All they have to do, all anyone had to do for that matter, was just go down and report you. I mean, you know, they could have said you had a man in your house overnight. A neighbor can report you for anything, and they will come up and seize you just on that person's what they have to say. Like, here's an example, you know. This happened a long time ago in 1919, but these two fellows are passing by the park, and they see a girl wearing slacks. In those days, they call it bloomers. Mm. They went and reported her, and the police came up and seized her. Oh. So
that's so ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. But so there was any excuse to bring you in. Now, the parents, which is really surprising, because any person could have reported you under that section 15, but they did have a statement there where they called it Section 17, where parents could have you put away until you were 21. And the idea was the parents, if they thought you were going to get married or something, they could prevent you from marrying. And actually, it wouldn't have made any difference because anyone could have reported you anyway. The idea is that women were allowed to marry at 18 years old, but they gave this privilege to women and then they took it away in the Female Refuges Act.
It's interesting that these policies seem really fascist, that you could take a woman and decide we don't like something you're doing and just seize you off the street just from a phone call. And considering the timing of a lot of this law and changes to this law was around the war when they are supposedly fighting a fascist regime, and it's another example of these types of things that are happening in our own country.
Yes, in this case, they could go into your home and seize you. Like you're on welfare and you've had a child out of wedlock, and they could seize you for that reason. And the police came in on me. I had just run off to get married, and we didn't get married right away. And about a week later, the police walked in and seized me. But while I was having breakfast with my future husband, I married him when I got out of jail.
There's a lot of inherent sexism in this law, just by the fact that there's a Female Refuges Act, there's no Male Refuges Act. You were living with your fiancé, you were about to elope, you were the one who was arrested. It's women who were wearing pants that were arrested or having children out of wedlock. A very anti-female law.
Yes, I have to agree with that. But you know, when we arrived at the home, my first feeling about it was that these girls must have been bad, and I wasn't like them. And the first girl who approached me, I wouldn't speak to her. The person I had run off with was Chinese, so I figured, well, I've been arrested for discrimination, racial discrimination, and not because I've done anything wrong. I soon found out that was completely erroneous. These girls had done very, very little, if anything, you know. One of the girls, she was, I think, 14 years old, I believe, and she said that her parents had her put there because they were afraid she might run off and get married like her sister did.
So let's talk about your experience. You've sort of touched on it a little bit already. Why, and I put that why in quotation marks, what was the given reason for your incarceration?
The reason for my incarceration?
Yes.
Oh, well, you know, there was a lot of prejudice about especially you've got to remember that with the Chinese Exclusion Act, there was a lot of prejudice against the Chinese just by the very act itself. And this prejudice, of course, extends right down into society and affected my father and probably most anyone else that a member of the family was defaming the family by marrying outside their race. So my family, my father walked in with the police and I was arrested. My mother and father were divorced, and my mother could have gone down to the police station, but I don't think she knew that I could be arrested for nothing. You know, nobody knew about this act. Otherwise, if we had known, we could have avoided getting arrested. But nobody knew it existed. So, and the funny thing about it is that even I wrote to Marion Boyd just a few years ago, and I mentioned the act, and she said, I don't know anything about it, neither do any of my colleagues. So this act just came in and went out, you know, and most people never heard of it.
Why hadn't they heard of it? Was it swept under the carpet? How did the government manage to keep this quiet?
Oh, they kept it quiet by burying it under the Department of Welfare. Like I went into the to look up in the annual reports, and I find infants' homes, old age homes, refuges, and so forth. And you couldn't tell which one was the one in which the girls were confined. It was really hard to find that I'd been arrested under the Female Refuges Act. And the only reason I found out was I went to the archives of Ontario, and I asked them if they had anything with my name on it and explained what happened. And they found my name on the Mercy Reformatory Register. And it said FRA, that I'd been arrested under that act.
And you've obviously been doing a lot of research in your challenge to this law. And you were informing me before we started this interview that you had a lot of difficulty in gathering names and information, and that perhaps some of this information has been destroyed.
Yes. Like, for instance, I went to the Belmont House, which it was originally the Belmont home. Of course, it's a very beautiful nursing home now. And I asked if there was any records of the girls who'd been there. And I was told that they had been destroyed because they didn't think they should have kept them. So I don't know where you would find the records of the girls that were arrested, that were sentenced in court right up until 1939. But after that, then we went on to the Mercer Register. Now, the girls for the Home of the Good Shepherds, I don't know where you'd find those records either. There is only one possibility. That is that in 1948, the judge of the Family and Juvenile Court was given the privilege of sentencing women under the Female Refuges Act. And there is a possibility that in the Family Division that there may exist some reports. I found three girls that had been actually sentenced in the Family Court by Judge Mott. And he wasn't supposed to send, well, they were sent to the Belmont home, so obviously under the Female Refuges Act, but he wasn't supposed to do that. But then they broke a lot of rules, you know, sending people to training schools that were over the age and things like that, you know. So, but at first I thought that there was one in 1939, and I thought, well, that must be me. But then it turned out it wasn't me.
How long were you incarcerated, and how were you treated both at the Belmont home and the Mercer Reformatory?
Well, I went into the Belmont home, and I was put on housework, and we slept in dormitories, and we were allowed to talk, and we were allowed to talk during meal hours, and we sat at a long table. So, and the girls worked in this huge laundry, with commercial laundry. Because as I say, the home operated under the Department of Welfare, so they could get funds from donations and so forth. And the government, municipal government, gave them 50 cents a day per person, and the provincial government gave them 10 cents a day per person. So I would say that the women who ran the home were quite, what should I say, quite nice. They thought that they were saving us from going to the Mercer Reformatory, that if the home hadn't existed, that's where we'd go. And they may have thought we were somewhat feeble-minded, because that was all through the history, and on the annual reports it said for feeble-minded women. Mm. But then that was taken off in 1931, and I'm not sure why it was taken off. They still continued under the Department of Welfare.
That's an interesting choice of words, too, really feeble-minded, in that feeble-minded seems to be defined as anyone with a mind sort of contrary to the government's goals, really.
Oh, you're quite right. You're absolutely right on that, because actually there could be no appeals under the Female Refuges Act, because we hadn't committed an offense. So when you don't commit an offense, you can't have an appeal. But for some reason or other, one appeal happened by a woman by the name of Bauer. And it was in 1930, and she had been in the Belmont home. And after her term was up, they sent her to a mental institution. So her father was trying to get her out. He had her examined, and they decided she wasn't mentally unfit. And so they brought her in for trial. And during the trial, they said, well, you've had these two children out of wedlock. One of them apparently died, but anyhow, and she said that it was her own business, and she wouldn't promise to do otherwise. Mm-hmm. And they decided that morality and insanity were similar, so they sent her. They kept her in custody.
So if you're immoral, you're insane, or if you have different morals than me, you're crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
So what do you think it was the goal, sort of the behind the written law, the goal of the government, the Ontario government, in bringing in this law? Was it an excuse to arrest women, a certain type of women? Was there a motivation towards work and in the war efforts? Maybe you can expand upon that.
Well, you know, I think the lawyer who brought that in, his name was McPherson, and he was a provincial secretary. He was a very eminent person. He'd worked for the government of Canada, and he was probably one of the foremost lawyers. So he certainly knew what he was doing when he brought the act in. But it just goes to show you how people will bow to expediency. The girls, as you, I neglected to say that originally in 1913, they were sentenced to 5 years in jail in the homes, in the refuge. And a lot of the girls, they ran away. And they're picked up by the courts. They came to public attention. Mm-hmm. And the public was really getting worried about it. And there could have been also, there was questionable labor. Labor could have been complaining because the girls were doing work free of charge. But whatever it was, that's when they made the changes that's when they brought in the Section 15. Now, it wasn't only that they brought in Section 15, that the pressures were put on the government, so to speak, to have, because these girls were being arrested and sentenced like that. But then they brought in Section 10. And it's Section 10... said that any girl who had venereal disease would be sent to a hospital, and any girl who was mentally defective would be sent to a mental institution. In other words, they were going to take these girls out of the home. So the Belmont home had a meeting, a protest meeting, and they complained vigorously about this new Section 10. They ignored completely Section 15, where the girls were being put in. So the thing is that by bringing in Section 15, where the girls could be arrested for practically for nothing, they were replacing the girls that were going out. Like, for instance, the girls who had, who apparently had venereal disease, would be going to a hospital. Now the hospital would be at the Mercy Reformatory. That's where they were treating the girls, because there was a clinic there and a doctor. And the girls who were mentally defective would go into the mental institutions. And now, this could have been the time when there was this specialization coming in. Actually, doctors were visiting the Belmont home once a week. So, you know, the idea of sending them off to the Mercy Reformatory wasn't the greatest idea. They weren't going to be treated any better over there. And also there was this thing about you didn't know if a girl had venereal disease or not because you only had the doctor's word for it. And, of course, the doctors were prejudiced against the women. Mm. The tests were secondary. That even, you know, the funny thing about it is they came in 1942, this would be during the war, of course, and said that it didn't matter if a woman went to her private doctor and he said that she didn't have VD or that the test said she didn't have VD. If the doctor in the reformatory said she had it, well, that was it. That was came first. So anyway, it was a matter of replenishing these women, which was probably just nothing more than expediency and So they might have had their own agenda when they were sending the girls off to the Mercer Reformatory.
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they had an agenda for most things that they did, and that there was a lot of political motivation behind this law is I think what's coming out in our discussion. And this type of thing really, it's still going on in prisons, women in prisons, in terms of prisons, men in prison as well are forced to work and work for basically slave labor in prisons. Prisons are getting bigger and bigger all the time. Prison is becoming a global big business.
I don't know if they've been doing these things in the past. It's just a matter of continuation, isn't it?
It really is. I think that the types of things we're talking about right now, we're talking about turn of the century, and you were incarcerated in 1939, the law was repealed in 1964. It's just reborn again, rehashed in a different way.
Yes, correct.
So arresting women for being idle and incorrigible, those are not part of the criminal code. Those are not crimes. In essence, really making these so-called criminals, these women being arrested, really more the victims of this law. And in your charter challenge against this law and looking for some sort of recognition that this law was actually unconstitutional, what reparations can be made to the victims of this law?
Well, you see, in some instances, when a woman is taken into custody, she can lose her children. And, I mean, I know of one woman who had her two children seized. They allowed her to keep the baby that she bore while she was in prison. And you know, she never smiled again, I can tell you. But for her, that was war. You know, and in my case, like I was treated so badly in the reformatory there, a deaf girl and myself were treated badly because we didn't follow the eugenics rules that were in place at the time. I was carrying a mixed race child, and she was carrying a child that was might be destined to be deaf, and these were unfit children, so to speak. So, and for me, you know, my child was taken to the hospital from the prison due to the abuse that I suffered. He suffered all his life with respiratory and skin disease and so forth. So, you know, I mean, it ruined my life. It ruined my husband's life. It ruined my son's life. How many other things, you know, that we have that are historical that we're saying are okay, and yet we want to pretend this never happened and doesn't count? And yeah, sure, there should be some reparation. First of all, we need an apology.
Mm-hmm. An official recognition that what was done to you and other women was wrong. And something to erase the stigma or the shame of being arrested under this law?
Well, yes, because a lot of people still think that we had done something wrong or we wouldn't have been there. You know, this was the consensus amongst my relatives that I must have done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And you know, I can't ask for pardon because I haven't done anything wrong. So literally speaking, I'm still stigmatized.
And that's interesting, playing into the perception as well, that there just seems to be this assumption that if somebody was arrested or if they were actually sentenced, that they did do something wrong, that the government is all-knowing, that that the laws are almost always just or in the interest of the people, and the people who are making the laws have this type of assumption or perception on their side, really.
Yes, that's correct, because people believe the law is all-powerful and that they couldn't possibly do anything wrong. No one could believe that they would bring in an act like the Female Refuges Act. I mean, who could even imagine it? And then the very fact that nobody knows about it.
So is that another goal of in bringing this challenge forward, is to get more public recognition?
Well, you know, I'd like to see some of the women come forward who were arrested or did time under this act. Now, the women from the Belmont home would be around my age, so they'd be, you know, quite elderly. But the women who went to the home of the Good Shepherds, they were there until 1964. They could be the mothers of some of the children. Like my own, I could be a grandmother, you know, of some children. But then how about the children who were the children of the women who were in those places? I mean, how were they affected by this act?
And their victims as well.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So what kind of support have you had from the media, from community, from other women coming forward to speak out about this?
Oh, so far we haven't found any women who were in the refuge come forward. We haven't found any. Of course, you know, it's very hard for them to know. That's why the stress is on home. They were in a home. They don't know they were in a refuge. They don't know they were arrested under the Female Refuges Act.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, and I've had quite a bit of support from the Chinese community.
And have you had any type of official response from the government? Or maybe you can fill us in at which stage your challenge is at and if you've been having communications.
Well, the position of the Ontario government is that this was the law at the time. Well, they say that the law has come and it's gone, and therefore that it's no longer in effect, so they're not responsible. How does it relate to anything that's going on right now? Well, I think the Mental Health Act probably is about the closest where they can arrest you for not taking your medication or something like that, you know. And determining that you're mentally ill, for instance, the same as they did with the feeble-minded women. They didn't give us any choices under the act, like under the Venereal Disease Act, the women were all treated whether they liked it or not. They weren't asked, they weren't told if they had it or they were sick. They didn't even know if they were sick or not. You know, you just line up and away you go. And
Another tie-in, a few times things have come up just in our conversation about feeble-minded, about tying this issue into women and psychiatry, the guinea pig issue, testing drugs on women. That's something else that they did in the 60s. They were experimenting with LSD mm-hmm. on women psychiatric patients to see what effects that would have.
Yeah, well, the drug that came in during the war, it was the first sulfa drugs that came in, and they were highly toxic. But they were fast cures. They're called a miracle drug. And these were used on Mercer women for whatever reason, who knows. And then the drug was thrown out a few years later, and the public was warned not to use it.
So what stage is your charter challenge at, and where do you go from here?
Well, we have to put in our application reasonably soon. I can't tell you what we're planning, but you know, we have certain expectations of what's going to happen, because you know, this is such an important act that I'm sure that women all over the country will be interested in this development.